thing goes towards us, there you go. The blade, yeah, that'll push back.
It's the first time you beat me out here, some of you. Must have been early start. We got you trained, okay, to be here. Good evening. And we thank the Meekins and their chefs. That's Sarah, Philip, and a few of us sous chefs. Thank you for another wonderful meal and time together. I guess I'm out of handouts. Is that true?
I can share. Who doesn't have a handout?
You need a handout.
I can share. Yeah, sure. We're a set. They're a set.
Yeah, we're like bookends. We're kind of a set.
Yeah, we're kind of a set.
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
The topic this evening is entitled The Gettysburg Address. And I look at this address or speech of Abraham Lincoln, which marks what I call the turning point of the American Civil War. Let me just inject here for you to think about the worst thing that ever happened in our history has already happened. Is that comforting? The worst thing about our history has already happened, and that's civil war. The worst thing that can happen to any nation is civil war.
Yes.
Brokenness. And we had a crisis. We've had several crises in our nation, just as human beings have crises in their lives. And so it's a human factor, this idea of a crisis. In fact, we're about to enter one soon. We've been talking about it. Not personally, perhaps, but nationally. And one of the things I observe as I study history is that a crisis is a time of strengthening, not destruction, but of strengthening. And it is also a time of renewing. And as horrible, and by the way, the Civil War is our own doing. Isn't that interesting about human crises? It's our own doing. The blame is within. It is a reflection of our own condition at whatever period of time it may be. And so we're looking at our own history, the growing, I like to think of America as a nation growing, all right? A growing nation, sometimes groaning. But when we look at the Gettysburg Address, it was a speech, yes, but it was also marking something that was occurring in our nation that we need to appreciate. We need to value what Abraham Lincoln said in a two-minute speech. It was simply, 136 seconds. That's under 2 minutes. And yet, if you look at my presuppositions and what historians have observed, this address, I don't know how many of you have ever learned this address or taught this address. Do you know that in California school code, the documents that all seniors are to study include the Gettysburg Address, as well as the Constitution of the United States, as well as the Declaration of Independence? I don't know if that is being actually done, but it is a requirement. And there's a reason why the Gettysburg Address is listed there. I believe it is an interpretation of America's purpose, of really purpose not only at the moment, but even for us today. And I want to preface again the whole presentation with these ideas. The Gettysburg Address, as some have studied it since, is our own greatest patriotic utterance or words. It's the greatest set of patriotic words in our own history. That's pretty profound when you think about it. It's worthy of our attention if this is the case. It's a piece of our property. It belongs to us. It came at a time of great stress, distress, pressure, near destruction, near self-destruction. And it is a very critical time in our history that we have to acknowledge. And yet out of that pressure and out of that struggle and strife in our own home or in our own homeland, there came an understanding we didn't have before that remains still, that remains still. First of all, again, note that it is worth your attention for you to study on your own. It is called a masterpiece, one of the greatest speeches in all of our history. Again, it's worth a give our attention. It's not he, but the, forgive the T is not there. But again, some have said it's the most famous address ever given by an American president. And he spoke to a nation that was divided. And he spoke to all. You know, the one thing about the president, he is the president of these United States. He was addressing the American people who are now face to face and in a hostile situation. And yet he was representing both sides, North and South. That's how he viewed himself. The South had already, shall we say, rejected his presidency, rejected his leadership, but he did not deny them as his fellow citizens. That's an important understanding to make about leadership and about this union that he fought so hard to preserve. And in this speech, because it was given at a dedication of a cemetery, and this it came, of course, after the Battle of Gettysburg, which is a turning point. By the way, every crisis has a turning point. You know what a turning point is? It's the beginning of the end. Okay? We look forward to turning points. It is the beginning of the end of something when you reach that place. And so we have here at this dedication of a cemetery, he gave purpose, first of all, to the living and the dead. Why the death? Why the dying? What was the sacrifice for? What is worthy of our sacrifice as an American people? What do we live for? What do the Americans live and die for? You see, and that's the open question. What do we have in common to live and die for? We forgot that for a moment. We forgot what was common to all Americans. And we can do that, especially after elections. We can forget, after all the competition and after all the issues that we take sides over, what it is that constitute us as one people. And Abraham Lincoln was able to summarize that for both the Southerner and the North, and why he was still their president as he stood there. Yeah, you had an offering, Sarah? Yeah.
We were saying what we are willing to live, to die for?
Yeah.
Liberty.
Whose liberty?
Our own personal liberty.
As well as what?
As well as our neighbor's liberty.
Our what?
Our neighbor's liberty.
What else?
Our country's liberty.
And we think, you know, one of the things we forget to do is think of our nation, our poor nation. Who thinks of our nation, right? To love and embrace this as our nation, that it belongs. We have a responsibility for its existence. By the way, our nation can't exist without us, okay? It doesn't run all without care. We have to care about our own nation. It's ours to care for. It's our responsibility, how we're to view it. And again, it's not perfect, because we're not perfect. And yet it is ours. It is ours to have, ours to own, and it's ours to express our life, our liberty, and our property. And how does that tie in, where we are today? So look at this president. This president, Abraham Lincoln, was bound. He held himself to the oath he took. Every president takes this oath. It's in the Constitution of the United States. And he held to it. He was bound to protect the Constitution. And that Constitution was the basis of union. It was the basis of our oneness. It was to uphold what was constituted, what was commonly binding to everyone. We are all bound to this Constitution. We've consented to this Constitution. We're bound to it until we change it. It came from us, we the people. We inherited it. and understand that we inherit it, we're to care for it, and if there needs to be correction, we are responsible for correcting it, but we are bound to it. Our own safety, our own security, our own livelihood, all that we have depends upon us being bound together. Is it, does it not? For our own self-preservation. And to divide it is to sacrifice all of our well-being, our own well-being. So we must include care for the nation in our own thinking and in our own identity. We need to identify with this country. We need to know how to define ourselves in relationship to our own country. We live in a time where we're challenged to despise. And if we're despising our nation, we must despise ourselves. Think of it. And so we think of what is good, not what is so much what is good to preserve. And we need to not throw out, as they say, the baby with the bathwater. But we have not thought about what is good to preserve. And that's what Lincoln had to think about. And Article 1, which I beg your pardon, is Article 2. That's wrong. Article 2 is the presidency's. It deals with the president. And it's very important to know that Article 2 is the presidency, because Article 1 is about Congress. And the first article deals with the supreme power. Where the power in this country is in Congress, not the president, please. Not at all. We, the people, through our representatives, are the supreme authority for our own government. We are a nation built on the government of the people, the government who choose their own rulers and make their own laws through their representatives. We are a self-governing people. And we forget that. We are not a democracy. We are built on the idea of we consenting to our own rulers and our own laws, because, again, they come from us. And from the Article 2, Section 1, the clause, the last clause in that section, before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. He presides not over the people. He presides over the states. The states preside over the people. Do you understand that? There is a layer, there is a wall of protection between the national and the people, and that's the state. And so he's the president of this. He's not the people's president, I'm sorry. He's the president of the states, very general. He's not going to come mow your lawn, okay? All right? He's not your pal, okay? He can't be your pal. He's not voted to be your best friend. It's not personal. And will to the best of my ability preserve, protect, defend the Constitution of the United States, defend the Union, defend the nation as a whole. And so this is what Abraham Lincoln, as president, endeavored to do. And again, his argument for taking arms for the Union and against the Confederacy. We'll look into that, because it's tied to this Gettysburg Address. This is the fruitage. The Gettysburg Address is an expression of the criticalness of the importance of how we ought to think at this of ourselves. And this is what he endeavored to do. And actually, there was no time but in 1863, the war started in 1861. He had no other opportunity but now to gather, to give his thoughts, since the war had begun, to an audience as that was there. So as President of the United States during the Civil War, again, I believe that was no accident that we had a Lincoln there at this important juncture in our history, the Civil War. He possessed something that was uncommon and perhaps still much so, and that's called magnanimity. Last week, we dealt with the turning point of the American Revolution, which is Valley Forge. That determined the direction and established American fortitude. It revealed then highlighted really what makes Americans distinct and separate in character from perhaps most other nations, and that's our fortitude. We may not be refined, cultured, as they say, or highly schooled in the classics, as they would put it, intellectual. We may not be the most intellectual people on earth, but we have fortitude, okay? Nothing else, all right? Stick-to-itiveness, if you will. And that's a distinguishing quality of this nation. And I would say, as far as leadership, the quality that Abraham Lincoln represents, another word that we want to look at is magnanimity. And I want to just define that for us. And it was very rare in this divided nation. What does it take to bind a nation together? What kind of leadership, rather, whatever level it is, perhaps it could be in your own home, it could be in your business, it could be in some society or association, some corporation or state, governor, town, city. What is it that, again, Lincoln portrayed here? Greatness of mind, that elevation or dignity of soul. What does it mean? Which encounters danger and trouble with tranquility and firmness, which raises the possessor above revenge. And that was so important, that this idea of a retaliation doesn't overcome us when we are somehow offended. And there was great offense, of course, at this period in history, and makes him delight in acts of kindness, which makes him disdain injustice and meanness. It means that this man operates from a basis of principle, not from a position of passion or personal position, and prompts him to sacrifice personal ease and safety for the accomplishment of useful and noble objects. And his noble object was to preserve the Constitution and maintain the Union. Let me suggest here that this speech of his, which was just, again, 136 seconds, remains for us, and the way he spoke it remains really, it's timeless. We can only appreciate it when we come to the verge of forgetting our own principles. He probably set in one sentence the basic principle, the linchpin of our country, the one idea that we are built upon, and we'll highlight that. But when we are on the verge of forgetting our own founding principles, can you name the founding principles? Do you know the idea that this nation is built upon? What idea is it? And then when we're losing our reason for being here, what is America's purpose for her existence? Why is she here? What is she meant to do? Why is she so unique? What is her uniqueness for? And we are morally perishing. Not virtually, but morally perishing for a vision. For what is the future supposed to look like for us? Where are we going? If you don't have a vision of where you're going, you're getting nowhere, right? You're either going backward, forward, but you have no aim. And we need to have a vision that is a direction of what is it that we're to go. So let's look at the Civil War. What was it all about? It was not about slavery. It was about secession. It was not about freeing the slaves. It was about keeping the Union from being divided over the issue of slavery. Okay? And that was uppermost on Abraham Lincoln's mind. No, I think most Americans had leveled themselves to simply being issue-oriented. Dwelling on the difference, all right, the battle over this very wicked institution. No one's supporting slavery. He didn't support slavery. No one is promoting the idea that we should maintain this awful institution. Of course not. When we spoke about socialism the other week, we said there's a right kind of help and there's a wrong kind of help. And we habitually do the wrong kind of help, okay? Why? I think we go back to, I wonder if I covered it, this idea of the Civil War being a result of our immaturity.
Impatience.
I forgot that. I believe.
You missed that part, yes.
Right. What caused the Civil War was, again, our own lack. And I think what causes division in our country today is the same impetuosity, impatience, and passion overrun by our emotions rather than by principle. And so it is a consequence. And I'm suggesting to you that we learn to be better at being this way. I'm wondering, however, we do let issues override principle. And I want to look at this as this slide. These are his words. He spoke these words in 1861 at his first inaugural address. And that was, I hold that in contemplation of universal law and of the Constitution, the union of these states is perpetual. What did he mean by that? You know, the union was something that had preceded the Constitution even. It began in 1774 in the First Continental Congress. That as a people, we began to join forces, to join together against a common cause. A common cause. And that cause, first of all, was against tyranny and for independence. You know, it's double-sided. We're for something, and that's independence, being free from the control of another. That's a wonderful idea.
Awesome.
To be free from the control of another. Another being and another nation. And then and as a result of that, you must foremost be against tyranny, which is the imposition of someone's will upon you. No one was made to be a slave. And that begs the question, made? Okay. But we find that we came together in defense, mutual defense. And this is mutual, not one over against the other. We came together in mutual defense. That is a concern for each other's independence as well. And thinking of others as much as ourselves. That was that's the basis of American Union. And it began to come, it was casual at first in the sense that it wasn't, but perhaps a coming together once in a while and to petition England. But as time transpired, and under the pressure of George III's tyranny, the Union began to get stronger and stronger. And that's what pressure sometimes does. It strengthens the body. And they began to form a body among themselves for that mutual protection. And so we began to have the Second Continental Congress. And they're the ones who authored the Declaration of Independence and separated. And then we had the Articles of Confederation. And this ongoing, growing union and strengthening of the union for what? Mutual defense, mutual good, mutual benevolence. Not imposing upon each other. It was all, again, a coming together. And so, but if destruction of the union by one or by a part only of the states be lawfully possible, if one could remove itself lawfully, the union is less perfect than before the Constitution. And the Constitution is the more perfect union. It's the final expression of that coming together. And it is not only the final, but the best that America could do for itself, which means that it was binding by consent, and it became law among themselves. And so this idea of perpetual because, again, it's beneficially, it's improving, it's growing, it is again, this bond that we have.
Now, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Now, why in the Constitution does it not state that it is perpetual?
The preamble. A more perfect union. No, we can always get better.
And the reason I'm saying that is because several states that ratified the Constitution had in their ratification that they could withdraw if their elected representatives said they could, Virginia being one of them. So they had already entered into the Constitution very tentative people went into that.
Absolutely.
They didn't want to get out.
Absolutely. That's why we have the first 10 amendments, to limit the control of the national. And this is what we had to resolve. Can you come and go? And this controversy that slavery brought forth challenged that idea. And Lincoln is reasoning with the nation at his election how that cannot be.
No, I'm talking about back in the ratification of the Constitution.
Absolutely.
At that time, slavery was throughout the entire nation.
But as we move along and as we develop a nation, that had to be resolved. Can a nation come and go? That was still tenuous. And we're new at this. by the way. By the way, America did not invent slavery. You know that, right? We didn't invent it.
I think it's too much on slavery. Slavery is really relatively insignificant issue.
But the ratification process, we were still new at surrendering to a national power. And this has to be tested. Can we remove ourselves? Absolutely. It had to be tested. Secession was being tested, not the issue of slavery,
right,
or promoting slavery. And that's what secession was all about. They decided they could walk out.
About economic thing, more about taxes and tariffs.
It was a matter of, again, what's more important, taxes, tariffs, slaves, or union?
Union.
Okay?
Union.
It has to be, because if one goes, we all go. All right, just reason with him for a minute.
Right.
Shall fugitives from labor be surrendered by national or state? That is the slaves. This is the if they run away, should they be given back? The Constitution does not expressly say. Who's going to decide this issue? Again, we have problems. We're going to have struggles. We're going to have differences. We're going to have things like slavery, things like bailouts. All right, all of these things are going to arrive in our house. Who's going to decide? May Congress prohibit slavery in the territories? This was not in the Constitution. Who's going to decide? The Constitution does not expressly say. Must Congress protect slavery in the territories? The Constitution does not expressly say. It's not there. So he reasons this. From questions of this class spring all our constitutional controversies, and we divide upon them into majorities and minorities. Basically, he's saying this. What is not in the Constitution, the people have to resolve. And how do we resolve these things in Congress? We let the majority of the people decide, and the minority yields to the majority. That's the way we operate. It doesn't mean that it's right, and it doesn't mean that it's wrong. Somebody won an election? Not everybody was in favor of it, but the minority yields to the majority, and that's how we operate. And if it's wrong, the people will change their minds. Do you understand? But that's how we operate. We agree that this is how we're going to operate. It's not about right and wrong. It's about what we, the people, decide together in the civil sphere. You decide in your conscience what's right and wrong, but that's not what the Constitution dictates, you see. It's how we resolve our problems. That's all. Very simple. We're not always right, and we're not always wrong, but we still resolve it one way or the other, and we can always change it. Our structure is such that we determine. We can amend, we can change, but that's how we do things. When the minority refuses what the majority decides, we're in trouble. That's what happened. All right? They got their feelings hurt, you see, and they got offended, and they were in a hurry one way or the other. They couldn't brook it. And they were willing to destroy the Union over their own preference, you see. But we have that quality of character, that self-government means that we decide. We, the people, do decide in this sphere about these things. But matters that pertain to your own state, that is, again, more specific. But here, as a nation of states, that's how we do it. They make a precedent. Now, if they can do that, then when they secede, they're saying when they have a problem in their own state as a seceded state, minority doesn't have to follow. They're going to have secession within a secession within a secession. Do you see? If you start that principle, it's just irreasonable. It's irrational because it's passion. It's not rational because we're operating by emotion. But constitutionally, this is how we operate. You have to reason from the Constitution. It's a lawful and legal matter, not moral. When you confuse morality with what is legal, where we get off.
That's right.
All right? You must not do that. The Constitution is a legal document. It's not a moral code.
That's right.
That's for your church. Okay?
Yes.
Then it's easy. Plainly, the central idea of secession is that if we promote secession, that we're promoting anarchy.
Yes, that's right.
That's what Europe does, okay? No offense against Europe, right?
Marisa?
Okay. Secession is anarchy. Anarchy. And next page. Why should there not be a patient... This is what he's calling for. Patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people. Now, the people may not be right on now, but maybe they will be eventually. They're growing up. They're maturing in this business of freedom. In America, it's about learning how to be free without too many crises, okay? But you know how hard it is to be free? How uneasy it is to be making your own decisions and making your own mistakes and being responsible for yourself?
It's very confusing.
Absolutely. And you're going to have your dips. You're going to have your lows. You're going to have your crises. You're going to have your bankruptcies. Right? But that's part of being free. We're showing the world how to be free and the mistakes that you make when you are free. It doesn't mean you're perfect. You're going to make mistakes when you're free. But you can unmake them. You're free to unmake them as well and correct them. So he said, I have patience and confidence in the justice of a free people. That they may not get it right this time, but perhaps later on they're going to get it right, okay? You have a chance to get it right later. You know, human laws are not set in stone. They can be changed. And this is what he's saying. I do not forget the position assumed by some that constitute. And by the way, some who are still impatient will do what? They'll go to the courts. Sound familiar? They don't like a decision, so they're going to take it to some Supreme Court and get it resolved their way. I'm pushed to get it. And that he says, I'm for that. However, you have to realize that when you use the courts this way, you lose your own self-government. Mm-hmm. You're letting a tribunal of men decide for you instead of the people do it. This takes patience to let justice. He's asking also, do any of you from the South think your position is wrong? And do any of you in the North think your position is wrong? Let's put it this way. Do any of you on this side of the aisle think they're wrong? Or anyone on this side of the aisle think they're wrong? If you do not believe you are in the wrong, then you have faith that the right will win. But it takes time for the right to win. And that's what he's saying. Are you afraid that you'll be proven unjust? And this is what he's reasoning with them. And go ahead and take it to the courts. And they did. And not only that, but you lose your liberty. You lose a degree of your own liberty when you do that. And that's what is happening, aren't we?
Yes.
So physically speaking, we cannot separate. I like his argument here. Again, these were the problems and questions in the mind of young America at the ratification. And it had to be questioned, it had to be tested, it had to be resolved. And Civil War resolved that question. Is there any opportunity to walk away, to take your marbles and walk away? But he says this, we cannot move our respective sections from each other nor build an impassable wall between them. A husband and wife may be divorced and go out of the presence and beyond the reach of each other. But the different parts of our country can't do this, right? It's not like a divorce in that way. He says, would you rather be strangers and make treaties with each other or friends that can make laws together? What's the better alternative? Wouldn't you rather be friends with each other and make laws together? Or are you going to be strangers and aliens one to another and make treaties? Can treaties be more faithfully enforced between aliens than laws can among friends? You see, where do you have the advantage, as friends or as foreigners to each other? True? And how many treaties have we made and how successful have they been with foreign nations, you see? You can't enforce them. You can't make another country keep a treaty, can you?
No.
There is no higher power for that. Not even the UN can do that.
That's right.
Absolutely. There's, and so you figure that one, all right? Is it rational? Suppose you go to war. You cannot fight always, and after much loss on both sides and no gain on either, you cease fighting. The identical old questions will come up over and over again. Nothing's resolved. And so we better be in the same nation together working out our problems than enemies, because this is annihilation of both sides. It is. And of course, as president, he says, I have my authority from the people, and that's in the Constitution. And they have not given me any authority to establish separation of the states. I have no authority. That's not within my job description, is to set up two nations. It's not there, and I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. I only see one nation. and I'm going to execute that privilege and that authority, which means that the South is in rebellion. The South is in rebellion against the Constitution. And so my job is to hand this nation to the next presiding officer, president, intact. That's my job. That's my duty. He wants to be faithful to his oath of office. Thank goodness he wanted to do that. He said, if I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. You see, what was preeminent? Saving the Union and not letting slavery be the reason, all right? So this is a quote he gave. Let me give you just a quick timeline of the Civil War. He became president he was inaugurated March 4th, 1861. South Carolina fired in Fort Sumter, a federal properties, and that's when the physical war, there was an aggression by the South, right? South Carolina actually fired upon federal properties and in endeavor to take it for its own. And what we're interested in is in the second year, 1863, we have the Battle of Gettysburg, 3 days war, July 1st, July 2nd, and July 3rd. And more soldiers died in that campaign than any other battle in all of the Civil War in those 3 days. I think we have 2,000 battles during the Civil War, and that was the worst one. Can you imagine 2,000 encounters? That much. Nothing is more bloody than our own Civil War. I think we had over 600,000, over 600,000 die in our own Civil War. My facts say that 50,000 died in that war. 50,000 died at Gettysburg.
One battle.
Yeah. In 25 square miles. Okay. And the town that Gettysburg was only, I think, 2,400 people. And there were 7,500 dead all around that town. And can you imagine? And of course, the surrender wasn't until 1865, April 9th. But we say the Gettysburg campaign was the turning point of the Civil War in our own country. And again, it's in Pennsylvania, of all states, that middle state of Pennsylvania. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if this is out of turn to say, but that is even in this day and age, that is so many dead. That's so many dead.
It's horrific.
And so I can imagine that in that day, it must have been even more impressive. Mm-hmm. So that being said, how incredibly stubborn or how incredibly blinded their own ego must have these people been to sit there hip deep in blood, literally, and to still go on for 1,999 more
conversations. It's amazing that we survived our own Civil War. That's the point. That we survived this. This is the worst period in our own history. We ought to have been, we almost annihilated ourselves. You see. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you have to think the population of the nation at that time is about 30 million total. So that gives you an idea of the magnitude, how many people, 600,000 out of 30 million, sounds like there was no family not touched by that.
Absolutely.
That's an incredible percentage.
It is brother against brother, nation, again, divided. So
that shows, in a sense, the amount of deaths you had, I've read extensively on this thing,
sure,
is how intense the feelings were that people were willing to
passion
fight at that level. Okay. Something you're not saying yet, and I don't know how you're going to get into it, but the South was fighting for its own self-determination and thought they were doing exactly the same thing their ancestors had did against Britain. And that goes, you read any of their writings, it's very clearly stated that they were saying, we don't want to be subject to a tyrannical government. And that was what they were thinking, because they wound up paying all the taxes of the United States government.
But there is a lawful way to do it. And
they're doing the same as our ancestors did.
We're asking the same questions today.
Yeah.
They were not. Because they were not being taxed without representation.
Oh, yes, they were.
No, sir.
No, 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 sir. I didn't say they were taxed without representation. I'm saying the way it came about, there was no income tax in those days. The South was like about one-third, one-fourth the population. They were paying about two-thirds of all the taxes.
What's your point?
Oh, I'm just saying that was the intensity of feeling.
Yes, absolutely.
On the economic issues.
You know, and the wonderful thing is, as we look back, is we've learned something. Okay, not to go there anymore with each other. In fact, we're probably the opposite. We're reticent and not eager to offend or do this ever again.
That's right.
It's deep in our history. Again, it's a wonder that we survived this as a nation, because our existence was self-destructing. It was self-destroying, and we don't want to do that. We have a constitution, and that's what authorized Lincoln to do what he did. The constitution. It's principle, not the impetuosity, impassionate we're talking about. Absolutely. And we are fearful of getting into that place where we are overrun by offenses and issues. Issues, again, no matter how terrible the issue or the moral question may be, we still must handle it constitutionally as a people, as a nation. How you handle it in your own home is another matter. But not as a nation, remember. We're thinking governmentally. Let's look at what Gettysburg was all about. Robert Lee came from the South hoping to invade the North. Okay, I forgive the lack of clarity of this map, but I wanted to see where Gettysburg was and where all the arrows converge. That's Gettysburg. It's not clear. But I had a enlargement of Gettysburg, but you wouldn't know where it was. I wanted you to see where the states were. There's Maryland and there's Pennsylvania, just the boundary lines, to see where that battle took place. It was only a 3-day battle, but it was a horrendous, again, effect. He wanted to, again, go over that northern region and destroy the railroads and just, again, Robert E. Lee is probably the best general of the two regions. He was the only commander-in-chief or general of the South. The North had several that were not as well-equipped and as Robert E. Lee. But nevertheless, he ran into
Point that Lincoln had offered Lee the command of all the Union armies.
Yes, he did. He refused because he couldn't see himself killing his own Southern neighbors and friends and so forth. That's an emotional thing. It was a horrific decision to make. So he went again up north, and it says that he sort of by chance came upon a northern army. And of course that was beginning. We mentioned before there were 2,000 land engagements. This one, of course, was the largest one of all. The Battle of Gettysburg was the largest and most significant of the war. About 160,000 Americans faced each other in what would prove to be a turning point of the Civil War. When it was over, more than 50,000 Americans were dead. The Confederate Army brought 75,000 men to the battle, losing 28,000 soldiers. The Union Army brought 90,000 soldiers in the battle, losing 23,000. And again, we've got over these numbers again, 634 cannon, 25 square miles. 569 tons of ammunition, 5,000 dead horses. The outcome was the fact that after this battle, the Confederacy never truly recovered from the devastation of this war. And just a summation of these 3 days. Again, by chance, it came upon an army, General Meade's, George Meade's army, and that's when the battle came. For a while, the South was gaining, and they were pushed back to Cemetery Hill. And again, assists came, new troops came. And July 2nd, we have the fact that Lee intended to do the flanks. There were parallel armies, you see, but he was going to the left and right flanks and tried to attack them there. That was not successful. And then July 3rd, there was the high point, and he tried to then attack the center, and that was the final rush, and of course there was no success. So Lee withdraws July 4th, and notice again it's the anniversary of our country, but July 4th he walks away. And as a result of this, of course, the suggestion came that a soldiers' national cemetery at Gettysburg became dedicated in November of 1863, the same year, though several months later. And they decided to raise a cemetery, sort of a memorial. And of course, these 2,400 inhabitants of Gettysburg initiated this. And I want to suggest in here that things like these memorials and projects when they are they're privately erected. They're from the people themselves, and it's initiated. Anything that is praiseworthy that is done, I think it that's that of consequence, of dignity, is always initiated from the people themselves. And so they had the assist, again, of others, but it was initiated by this local town. There were about 7,500 dead soldiers in the area. You can imagine the filth, the stench, and all of that. A local lawyer began to seek a means of erecting this memorial cemetery. 17 acres were dedicated to it, and it cost at that time $2,435. And burials became reburials, and burials began their be their project. And you can see it took several months to bring this about. It wasn't until 1873 that they brought bodies from the south to join those that were buried in the north in this Gettysburg. And so it was a long-term project. It was carried out quite successfully. And it was turned over to the National, to the War Department, May 1st, 1872. But in the beginning, it was handled by the state of Pennsylvania. The design, of course, was to symbolize the equality. There was, again, it gives you the idea of how it was set up. There were ceremonies, and the orator that they asked to speak was Edward Everett. He was supposed to be the most renowned orator of the country at that time. He spoke for 2 hours. Can you imagine?
Can I ask a quick question here?
Yes.
It says 7,500 dead soldiers are in the battlefield, but yet you just said
50,000 were lost.
People died. So how many people are in the actual cemetery?
I probably at this point in time, I only see 7,500. All right. But I would ask the same question about the 50,000, but I don't know where that ends.
And they're just buried in other places, that 25 square miles?
Right, not there. Okay. Because we're dealing with a range of marches and so forth. So it was quite devastating. And so notice here that, of course, he came with an oration, and Lincoln was only asked to do it casually. He was asked, he didn't have as much time as the others. And yet his oration, less than 2 minutes, was the one that was remembered. It's interesting to note that. He said of Lincoln's speech, "I should be glad if I could flatter myself that I came as near to the central idea of the occasion as in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes." And that was Edward. That's an honoring to the president. And that was, again, his recognition. And of course, Lincoln wasn't supposed to take much of a part, and yet it was, again, the most important part. Let's look at the speech itself. And I divide into three ideas. If there's anything that would summarize the concept of what we began to see ourselves, he began to give a vision. He began to give that audience a definition of America, a purpose for their lives at that present time in history, and what to look forward to, where we can go together. And of course, he was seeking to persuade the audience for union, for keeping the nation as one. And I believe the glory, and what he has here, set forth the glory, or what is America's greatness? America's greatness and uniqueness is that it's built on one idea, that all men are created equal. That is the phrase that produce the Constitution of the United States. How can men that are created equal live in political society on that one idea? And this is what separates this nation from all the rest. You will not find any nation prior to 1776 that endeavors to build a political nation or political body based on that idea of man. Now, remember, it was the beginning, not the end. It was the goal. It was the intent of the Founding Fathers to establish a nation with that idea, as again, unbelieving of that idea as many might be. But that proposition that all men are created equal. Americans are uniquely united, are related in some common, and this principle is sacred because it doesn't come but by revelation. It only comes from the scriptures. It didn't come from human intellectual understanding. It came from revelation and agreement to the revelation. We have a common history. We share common trials. We have our problems. The problems of the South are the problems of the North, and so forth. And we have a basis for resolving our own problems. We have a reference. We can reason from this body of laws called the Constitution. And we simply need the maturity to do just that, to reason together. The undergirding principle of the Constitution of the United States is that principle. But on the flip side, the fact that all men are created equal is that we have all decided by consent that that will be our government, that we are governed by consent. So these two go hand in hand, that we consent to this idea and we consent to a government to be established on that idea. It's our decision to do just that. We have covenanted together by a Declaration of Independence. We signed that. Our ancestors signed that in our behalf. They assented to it. They assented to the Constitution that expresses that consent and that society that will implement this idea, that will practice it, that will show the world what it looks like. The world doesn't know what such a thing looks like. We're here to demonstrate what does a nation look like that believes that all men are created equal. Our purpose for living, the national purpose, again, I think could sum it all up, reasoning from him, that our purpose is what would we devote ourselves to doing every day as an American? To keep this union, to preserve it, not to destroy it, not to work to undermine it, because it is our life, it is our well-being, it is our health. Our national well-being is related to our personal well-being. Don't disconnect. Don't disconnect with what is occurring in your life with what is occurring in the nation as a whole. Don't separate yourself from your own nation. We are responsible. It is ours to own. It is ours to care for. And that idea has not been a part of our education. And we need to consider that. But the war is not about slavery, he says. This war will make or break what past generations had worked to create. A far greater problem than deciding whether or not slavery will be tolerated, but whether our nation can exist. Will we let our disagreement destroy, right, what we own in common, which is a nation? Can this endure? And I think the terrible injury we did to each other in that war made us correct, brought a correction in that. The practical dream, I call this like a vision. What is the practical? Practical means it's doable. It's not just fantasy. A dream is a fantasy. It's an imaginary thing. But practical, there are practical dreams. And the practical dream is, let's have a renewal, all right? A renewed concept of what this nation is to be. And that is, again, this idea of a new birth of freedom, he calls it. A new birth, a new understanding of what it means to be free. Free from the control of another, as it were. And to by our self-government, in our freedom, govern ourselves. What are free people supposed to do? They're supposed to govern their own lives, lest they be governed by another. You see, how do you keep yourself free? By governing your own life and not requiring. You know, there are going to be a lot of things that will be held out for us. We have wish lists, right, to our government. Or there's a lot of gifts they're going to promise, all right? You know, the idea is that you exchange a gift for a degree of your own independence. So what if, when all these goodies are held up, we can safely say, I don't need that, thank you, all right? I don't need that. Now, if you need it, by all means, take it. But the point is, try not to need it. Try not to need it. Let's try not to need, all right? And that will benefit the nation, will it not? But self-government means I will try and endeavor not to need it. And I will not exchange any more of my liberty for that need. And so what is the task? What is the work we need to do? Keeping, saving, sustaining, upholding, and defending, all right, ourselves, this Constitution, to mature, to bring it along, to advance it. It's far from being finished. It's not finished. It's not at the peak. We're probably still junior high school, all right, in our experience as one people. And we're going to have more crises. We're going to make more mistakes, but we can correct them and show the world how free people live, make mistakes, and learn from them, and go forward. We get a little embarrassed, all right? We're a little red in the face sometimes. We don't look too smart. We never do, all right? We're kind of sloppy, but we're free, okay? We're free. You can have your degrees, but we're free, all right? Conclusion. The speech itself, some have remarked, really be able to shape, all right, our thinking. It came at a time when we need to stop because it was so awful. We need to stop and think and soberly examine our history, know our history. Unfortunately, we don't know our history like we need to. But, and a reason for, again, this idea of a victory on the Union side and this idea of keeping our government, keeping our self-government. In 2 minutes, Lincoln was able to give them all pride, consoling, purpose, hope, and a united goal. They could take that home. It was a 2-minute speech they can take home. They can read and put it in their pocket and use it. It wasn't a long document like the Declaration of Independence. I would say that this is sort of the second rendition of the Declaration of Independence, something we can hold in our hand and walk away and understand. It was... again, effective, it was simple, it didn't mention slavery, it didn't mention all that was wrong with America, okay? What keeps us together is what's right with this country. There's enough that's right to keep us together as a nation, worth keeping together, worthwhile, of value. And so he didn't mention slavery, he didn't mention the South, he didn't even mention Union, he didn't mention Emancipation Proclamation, which he had given earlier that year, which freed the slaves of the rebellious states. We can talk about the Emancipation Proclamation in January, right? He did not address them. He didn't provoke, right? He simply wanted to bring together. And sometimes our speech, we can be wrong, and we can be right and wrong at the same time, right? It's not always right to be right. But it was binding. It was bringing together. This is his magnanimity. And so he equated what the dying with the living. The dying and the living had the same purpose, and that was, again, to renew our dedication to freedom, mutual freedom, each other's freedom, not one party against another, one region against another. And so he presented what was exactly needed for that moment in time. Again, some of you can imagine what was before them after the Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg. In his Gettysburg address, President Lincoln reminds all Americans, not only then, but even today, of our unique history and our unique responsibility and our practicable, doable ideals. And he appeals to our humanity, to the soft part of us, not to the hardened aspect, not even to the intellect, but to our common humanity, our human nature. That our understanding, our compassion, our sympathies, our common sympathies, our common needs, our common affections. And he appeals to again, keep self-government, liberty, and of course justice, not just for then, but for time ongoing. And so he spoke in a language, as you understand, again, it's not neoclassical like Edward Everett's was, modeling after the Greeks and the Romans in their high-minded speeches and four-syllable words, so to speak, John Lockean sentences, etc. It was just plain American speech, as you know, so that the educated and the uneducated could understand it. We can appreciate that. And of course, I want to leave with this idea that today we are still growing into the Constitution. Do you know, some people think the Constitution is a living document and it changes with us. No, it doesn't change with us. We need to grow up into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's a high-minded document, and we have far to go before we can fit those shoes.
That's right.
You see, it's not that. We need to grow up into the Constitution, be equal and worthy of operating it. We haven't done too well. We don't even know what it says. The Constitution is designed for the government of rational, free-thinking, magnanimous men, and not for the intellectually immature who are susceptible to the influence of others and are slaves to their own passions. The Constitution appeals to a people who live, what? To promote liberty and prosperity for posterity. You've got to live for your children. You're not living for now. You're living for what those who will follow us. Absolutely. The Constitution, the essential, what are the challenges that we continue to have today as we did then about this nation? First of all, what are the challenges? To ignore the history of liberty. Liberty, check this out, is a divine thing. It's divine. It didn't come out of mud. Okay? It did not come from outer space, so to speak. It didn't evolve in us. Liberty is a divine thing. And it's sacred. It's sacred. And understand, the history of liberty is uphill. The history of liberty has a great deal of opposition. And the more opposition you give to liberty, the more it advances. It cannot be stopped. It's an uphill struggle for liberty, though. It's a daily thing. We've laid back and took a vacation, okay? Mm-hmm. In a sense. One of the things we Americans have to learn, not only how to be free, show the world how to be free, but how to be affluent. Do you know what I mean? We don't know how to be affluent. How to have wealth. How to use our wealth. We're like a little kid at a candy store with a $5 bill. Now, candy used to be penny a piece, okay, when I was growing up. And so, boy, everybody would hit Mrs. Murphy's candy store with a dime. You get 10 pieces of candy with a dime. And you can get those long licorice sticks, and those jawbreakers last forever for a penny, And we're like a child in a candy store with a $5 bill and just getting all we can, okay? We don't know how to use the abundance that we have. We got a way to go. We need to know how free people live with affluence, you see, and not feel guilty about it, okay? We're learning to distinguish the business of local self-government from the business of the nation. We don't confuse the two. We're retaining as much of our own power and self-government secured to them under the Constitution. We've got some power. We still have the power under the Constitution, and we have to retain it. And of course, upholding the decisions made by we the people of Congress assembled. Congress are our rulers. We put them there, and we have to assent to them, uphold the decisions. And if we don't like the decisions, we just change the congressman. We have the people. We have the vote. We have the power. You see, we the people. And we can do that. I love the fact that every 2 years we can change our wardrobe, okay? Mm-hmm. Right? New clothes. Get new clothes. Every 4 years, perhaps, we can change what people see. Or every 6 years. There's great wisdom in that. And of course, we must not, and of course, another other challenge is letting the politics of party or issues divide them from the principles of the Constitution. Yeah. No expediency should override the binding Constitution. This is our union. This is our body. This is what makes us a people is the Constitution. And that's the Gettysburg Address.
Fantastic.